The Vicar General told me yesterday that the approval process for our future bishop is proceeding faster than expected, and there may be an announcement, in fact, as soon as Friday. That's as maybe, but I thought it would be useful this evening to talk a bit about the first four bishops of Dunedin, because to some extent those four episcopates frame up the what followed afterwards and the situation we now find ourselves in. Well, we all know that there was the Jenner controversy preceded the appointment of Bishop Neville, but the Jenner controversy is really irrelevant because Bishop Neville bestrides this diocese like a colossus. His ministry lasted almost 50 years. And where is Bishop Jenner when he retired from the field of attempting to get himself appointed, retired to a country parish and wrote hymns and continued a gentle scholarly existence? He thereby showed that he would not have had the mettle to have created this diocese in the midst of so many difficulties. And that's what Bishop Neville had: energy, drive, determination, never give up, and above all, he married money, a lot of it, and he used this money on behalf of the diocese. There were negative things about Bishop Neville. He was irascible, highly argumentative, an abrasive person who often quarrelled with his clergy through the pages of the newspapers and often drove them off as fast as he brought them in. But for all that, his energy, drive and determination was the determining factor which made things work. One of his biggest problems was persuading clergy to come down here and stay here. And the problem was that clergy often left soon after they arrived, either because they found that the rough colonial conditions didn't suit them, or because they weren't being paid properly and promptly as they'd been promised, or because they fell out with Bishop Neville. So Bishop Neville resolved to solve the problem by setting up his own theological college and training people on the spot who would be much more suited to the conditions here. And so it came to pass that in 1893 Selwyn College came into existence. He soon found out — he paid for it, by the way, he bought the land and got the whole thing set up — that it couldn't work just as a theological college, so he realised that he had to turn into a university college along Oxbridge lines and allow undergraduates in. And by and large, this project succeeded. The people who passed out of Selwyn College tended to stick around, certainly more than the ones who were produced by College House. Another problem was there was nowhere for the bishop to live, so he just went out and built his own episcopal residence up on the site of what's now Columba College. Yes. The other thing he did, of course, was he was very keen to push the cathedral project. And really, when he retired in 1919, he felt that he'd got that, having completed that, this was a significant landmark around which he could retire. Of course, Neville was also a high churchman. He'd kept that pretty quiet at first in the wake of the Jenner controversy, but he kind of felt he could let things out of the bag, particularly in that wonderful photograph I was talking about a few weeks ago that shows some apparelled in chasuble and mitre and crozier at the beginning of Holy Cross St Kilda. So it came to pass that Bishop Neville retired in 1919 and died 2 years soon afterwards and is buried in Warrington Cemetery. He was married twice, he had no children, and when his first wife died he married her companion who looked after her. She actually lived on into the interwar period and left quite a big sum of money to Vincent Bryan King, the famous social worker priest here of the son of Bryan King. She was so impressed by what he'd done for the poor. And so the next bishop was Isaac Richards, another Englishman. He'd been around in this diocese for quite a long time, and the clergy turned gratefully to Isaac Richards because he was approachable. He was easy to get along with. They'd had enough of being bossed around. And Isaac Richards was a man of deep spirituality. Everybody agreed about that. He had a man of big ideas, but he wasn't good on details or administration and finance. And the problem was that as soon as Episcopate began, there was a minor depression after the Great War, and then the Great Depression started towards the end of his Episcopal ministry, and this just completely frustrated everything he wanted to do. These were very difficult years, and he was not temperamentally suited to meet the challenge. There was church building and parish establishing still going on. St. Michael Sanderson's Bay, for instance, was built in 1924, as it now is. And so he retired. By the way, one of his sons, two of his sons have been killed in the Great War. Another one was wounded. But he went on to become the headmaster of Christ College and is immortalised in Richard's House, which is there today. Well, he retired, and in 1934, the clergy had had enough of this, and they got together in a little cabal and resolved to elect Tony Fitchett's grandfather, Bishop Fitchett. The great patriarchal Fitchett, of course, had been a Methodist minister who had then been retreated as an Anglican priest and was the Vicar of All Saints until, I think, about 1924 or so. And Bishop Fitchett was his son. He was the Vicar of St. John's Roslyn and Archdeacon of Dunedin. And the clergy resolved to put him in because they knew that he was good at admin and finance, and he certainly turned out to be. And he was the salvation of the show, really. He said, right, the first thing is you can't really afford me, so I'll go on being the Vicar of St. John's Roslyn, so you can just pay me a reduced stipend. Curates can help me run the parish. Secondly, we're going to have some amalgamations around here of parishes. But he grafted away at the whole issue of money and administration. The clergy began to be paid properly and promptly. He began putting their vicarages right. Clergy morale rose. They began to work better and harder. The other thing that Fitchett was good at was making the periphery feel that the centre cared about them. He travelled a lot round the diocese, and he also was reminding the periphery about what mattered to the centre. There was a sense of communication, a sense that the guy at the centre understood what was happening. In 1950, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Fisher, toured New Zealand, and he noted confidentially in his diary that of Bishop Fitchett that he was, quote, a dry old stick with a weak sense of humour, but that didn't really matter. He may have not have been the most glittering personality, but he'd put the Diocese of Dunedin right through some of its most difficult years, and so when he retired in 1952, he could say that he'd done a great job. Then along came Bishop Johnston, who had been the Vicar of Whangarei, the first Bishop of Dunedin to be trained at St. John's College, Auckland. He was a Kiwi. And, of course, he was bishop through the salad days of the 1950s and the 1960s. We might just want to remind ourselves about some of the major things that happened there, apart from the baby boom generation, some of whom are here tonight, who helped the diocese along tremendously as they were sent off to Sunday schools and youth groups and then became churchgoers. There was the famous Wells campaign in the 1950s. The Anglican Church had never... There was an endless problem about getting enough money to make the diocese work. You know, Bishop Neville had always been going off to England on begging expeditions. People must have dreaded colonial bishops coming along on their fundraising tours. Well, the Wells campaign was the first professional attempt to get... planned giving going in parishes to really tackle laity about their financial responsibilities. A lot of controversy, a lot of people got hacked off about it, but it succeeded in really beginning to fund the Anglican Church properly. These were the years of the great debate over church union. They were the years, the 1960s, that saw the introduction of the new liturgies. Remember the little orange book that came out in 1966, followed by the grey book in 1970? Well, all started then. There were other interesting things going on. There was quite a Catholic penumbra of the clergy in those days. Let's recall Father Perkins, the warden of Selwyn College from 1950 to 1954, an Englishman trained at the College of the Resurrection Mirfield. These were the years of the golden era of All Saints under Father Charles Harrison. Father Harding, his very Catholic ministry in Andy Bay. All of this was happening in these years, good years. But, you know, for those with eyes to see, there were some deep facts going on behind all this. Through the episcopates of Richards, Fitchett and Johnston, the population of Otago and Southland had been growing. But looking at the actual Anglican figures, they had not been keeping up with that growth. It had been slightly decreasing. So even in the salad days of the boom times of the 50s and the early 60s, the proportion of Anglicans to the rest of the population of Otago and Southland was slowly slipping away. And the other problem was that even in the good years of the 50s and 60s, the diocese wasn't producing enough young men entering the sacred ministry. They made up the shortfall to some extent with older married men. You know, these are the years of Neville Selwood et al. Coming on stream. But and we'd be impressed by the ordination figures today, but they weren't enough for the diocese, which is why the diocese has always tended to be a net importer of clergy. So, yes, that's probably enough for now. Johnston went on, I think, to become the Bishop of Waikato after that. He might have even become Archbishop. It was a great ministry, yes, followed briefly by Walter Robbins, who died of a heart attack. What a handsome man he is. Look at these photographs along the boardroom at Diocesan headquarters, and Bishop Robbins is easy. I mean, he had a great photographer who was working with great material. So on that note, I'll conclude.